She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And remember, we don't tell you what to think, but we really do just want you to. Our show today is made possible due to the generous support of Habitat for Humanity. And we thank them not only for their support, but for building homes, communities, and hope, and for giving people a hand up, not a handout. We love Habitat at Mrs. Green's World. The name of our show today is Defending the Arctic. And our guest to talk about that with us is Mary Nickel. Mary is the National Activist Network Director at Greenpeace, and we love having anybody from Greenpeace on our show. It's like I want bells to go off. She project manages their office's adaptation of Greenpeace Greenwire, a social network that allows Greenpeace supporters from all over the globe to build strong relationships and run high-impact campaigns together. Welcome, Mary, and thank you for taking the time to answer our questions about what's going on in the Arctic.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start. I always think it's good to give our listeners a little refresher on the big mission of Greenpeace in general. Can you do that for us?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Yeah, so we are an environmental organization that was founded actually out in this region, the Pacific Northwest region, in the 70s. And, you know, we work to promote green and peaceful solutions for a sustainable world and work on a variety of different campaigns and use creative communication and direct action to reach our campaign goals.
And you just mobilize communities globally in a hurry sometimes. It's pretty amazing to me what Greenpeace can do when they activate their matrix. It's like I get the emails and it's calls to action that are many times very easy to do and so important that we don't ignore them.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Speaking of hot topics and timely show guests, it's like I love it kind of when we have a show guest that's planned quite a bit out and then there are news reports, sadly, but very topical. It's something that's happening, shell drilling in the Arctic. We just had the oil spill off of Santa Barbara, which I think makes Americans pay a little bit more attention. So what's happening as we speak? Can you just provide us with the, I think, two things, a history of Greenpeace and having it be a campaign for stopping shell drilling in the Arctic and how it fits in with the overall mission?
Yeah, absolutely. Great question. Yeah, so for Greenpeace in particular, for the past 4 years, we have been working on our Save the Arctic campaign and raising awareness around this beautiful, pristine area of the world that previously, before we really started to see the most detrimental impacts of climate change, was just covered in ice. But the past few seasons, what you've seen is that the lowest sea ice minimums that we've had. And, you know, industrial companies are able to go up there for the first time ever and do things like explore for oil.
And the and irony so, being the yeah. very companies that is causing a lot of the melting, I just had to throw that in. There is irony there.
You can't make this stuff up. The very exactly. companies that are causing climate change are trying to profit from
yep.
climate change.
Yep.
And so, yeah, so globally, Greenpeace has been working on this issue for a while, you know, and indigenous communities in the Arctic have been working on it for much longer, working to make sure that, you know, we protect this pristine place, you know, just for the pure beauty of it, you know, one of the last remaining untouched places on the globe. But as well as, you know, in January when it became public that the Port of Seattle had signed a lease with Shell to host the drilling fleet here in the city's harbor. At the same time, Nature released a study saying that, you know, if we are going to, you know, try and stay as close to 2 degrees Celsius as possible, which is the amount of warming that we believe that we can handle, there's no way that we can burn any of the oil that we find up in the Arctic. So not only is it, you know, a fool's errand to go up there because of the 75% chance of an oil spill that could happen, predicted by Obama's own scientists, but the oil that we get, you know, we can't burn anyways.
And it, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
It seems to me that not unlike when you talk about preserving the Amazon rainforest or any of the rainforests, any old growth forests, people have to wake up somehow and realize the connection to us as a globe. I mean, it's a very small planet. So what are some of the other reasons? I get it. I mean, believe me, I get it. Why should we all care so very much about the Arctic? It is preserving cultures and countries and population. And what are some of the other reasons why we should care? I mean, it's just one planet.
Yeah. Well, you list a lot of great reasons. But, you know, where we're at in the climate movement around the globe is we're starting to see companies like Shell go to extreme measures to get the last bit of fossil fuel that they can. And so it's also about saying no. You know, about drawing a line and saying, we want different choices. We don't want to have to choose to, you know, power our lives on fossil fuels. We want to be able to choose to power our lives on renewables. And that's really the state of things right now, is we're working to shift the whole way that we get energy and we power our lives. And it's projects like Arctic drilling that are setting us up with the false belief that we need that oil and that we won't be able to survive without it, which is just not the case.
And it's always, to me, trying to get your eyes to be on the ball that we shouldn't be watching. We should be really putting our energy into renewables, which are there, and there's wind and there's solar. But what we're doing is staying in the old paradigm of fossil fuel. It just kind of blows me away. And doesn't it... Isn't it part of the vicious cycle that the more the Arctic, thaws and the waters become warmer, it just moves us in that unpredictable and dangerous storms and weather extremes? I mean, isn't it all connected to what's going on up there?
Yep, that's right. Yeah, I'm certainly not a scientist, but I read a lot about this issue and the impacts. And you know, if you read any of the scientific reports, a lot of what they're saying is, you know, the Arctic is the air conditioner for the globe. It is something that provides these key triggers to help cool down other areas of the globe. And so when you start to mess with the Arctic and start to see, you know, sea ice minimums, scientists are really worried about what this will have on all the various jet streams and the different climate patterns that we see around the globe. And how those things will shift and how, you know, society will be able to adapt.
And, you know, I'm like you, I'm not a scientist, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that that ice helps cooling of the planet. And the more it melts, mm-hmm. the more we're going to warm up. It's like, there it is in plain English. And the faster it melts, to me, the more trouble we're in. And I live in Arizona, so believe me, I am not looking forward to anything that has the title warmer around it. I mean, it really does. I feel like protecting that ice means it protects all of us.
Yep, that's right.
What about, since Greenpeace is such an international organization and operates in so many countries around the globe, what's the overall mindset and thought of people in the world about creating something like a global sanctuary and really staying away from that area for oil drilling and any other heavy industry? What's the will of the people?
Yeah. So, you know, the past few years, we've been able to engage over 6 million people around this issue of protecting the Arctic from industrial practices. And so that's quite a lot of people across the globe in a variety of different cultures and countries that recognize that this is a key issue of our time. So it's definitely something that folks care about and that we're starting to see, particularly here in Seattle, that people are willing to put their bodies on the line. to save this pristine place and to make sure to do everything they can to stop the most detrimental impacts of climate change.
And it's a perfect segue for what I referred to in the opening of the show, tell us what happened on Saturday, May 16th with the kayakers. I mean, it really is unprecedented from what I know of the kind of protest that this was.
Yeah, well, Saturday, I just feel really lucky to have been there and have been a part. It was
I
a
can't believe
day.
You got to be there. It's like, I wish I could have been there.
Yeah. The images from the day are amazing. And what they do is they really tell the David and Goliath story of what's happening out here, where you have these colorful kayaks, facing off against this big monster that is the Polar Pioneer. And so on Saturday, the day started, the day was kicked off by some of the coastal Salish canoe families in the region. They launched first and led everyone else off the shore. And then there was an indigenous-led jam session. There's also something called the Solar Pioneer. It is a barge that has been parked within view of the Polar Pioneer that's powered by solar power that's being used as a protest vessel as long as the Polar Pioneer is here. And then from there, the Coastal Salish canoes led everyone towards the mouth of the Duwamish River. And that's where if you've seen any of the photos, you see boats that look like they're pretty darn close to the Polar Pioneer. And there were also some really special moments that happened there where indigenous leaders shared about their culture and why they're here to protect the Arctic and protect their way of life. And then from there, there was a traditional canoe landing that happened right ashore where the Duwamish welcomed other tribes and then everyone else onto their lands. And there were some more indigenous speakers, folks like Faith Gemmel from Alaska who came down to talk about the impact that drilling in the Arctic will have on her community. But all in all, just an amazing day. And
the unprecedented part to me is typically tribal nations don't use this venue, this type of protest, venue or whatever the word is, the way to get the word out. So for 50 tribes to be represented, I think that's what I read. I think it was 50 intertribal canoes.
There were eight canoe families.
Eight canoe families.
Right.
So what was the impetus behind it and why that Saturday?
Well, the impetus behind it was to Seattle has protests running in its veins. And so there's certainly been a lot of impressive movements and whatnot that have happened here in Seattle and have been sparked by Seattle. But people here really wanted the opportunity to have a very public, beautiful protest that was inviting to other participants to take part. Because we know that there's one thing that Shell is afraid of, and that is ordinary people taking action to stop them. And then in particular, with the canoe families, this is their territory and their land, and we were lucky enough that they were willing to take part and participate in the day. And it was a group of folks affiliated with Idle No More Washington that made a call out to their community to come out and be a part of the day.
And do things like that really help raise the global consciousness? I mean, it really became an international news item. Do people start looking a little more closely and maybe caring a little bit more when there's an event like this?
Absolutely. And it's people's movements like this, it's all about building community and building network and building connections. And, there were people coming off the water on Saturday that had tears in their eyes because they were so moved by the event that happened. What these fossil fuel companies are trying to do is they're trying to control natural resources and draw divisions between us. But these are the sorts of events where we can come together in community and talk about the world that we're trying to create and really celebrate what it's like when people across difference come together and unite to stand against, you know, a big Goliath like Shell.
Right. A big, big, big Goliath. If there's such
that's
a
right.
thing, there's no small Goliath, but Shell is a formidable foe from where I sit.
Mm-hmm.
So what about drilling already starting? From what I read on your website and some of the other research I've done, Russia, the Russian government, already has some semi-national oil giant drilling in the Arctic. Is that current? Are they doing it now?
Yeah, so Gazprom is the name of the state-owned oil company, and I am not up to date on what has happened in this current season, but yes, last season they did successfully drill for some oil, although they weren't able to find much. But what's happening here in the U.S. Arctic in particular is Shell is the last remaining company that has had access to those leases that were sold by the Bush administration during their time in office, that is still going after getting oil up there. And so every other company has just said financially it's not worth it. You know, the price of oil has dropped. We're not going to see our money back. But there's something going on for Shell where I think they really see this as they see the writing on the wall and they see that, you know, the tide is shifting and people are rising up across the globe fighting fossil fuel projects. And so this is about, you know, making sure to stop them from getting up into the U.S. Arctic and then as well as to set an example for the rest of the globe that we're not going to stand for this.
And, you know, it's funny, I know this dates me, but there used to be a commercial years and years ago about it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. And what I read, I did love it when I read in my research about their first foray into the Arctic for Shell. It was really rough seas and weather caused them to run aground, and they were all evacuated by helicopter. Not a good sign to,
yeah.
for Shell, one might think.
Absolutely, yeah. So Mackenzie Funk wrote this really amazing piece called The Wreck of the Kulik. It ran in the New York Times Magazine. And it's like a crime thriller. It, you know, it's just, you read it and you're just seeing yourself, like, who is making decisions over there that is allowing these things to happen where, you know, they're putting their workers at risk and they're putting their bodies on the line. And, you know, that's the thing about the Arctic that I haven't mentioned yet. It's just that, you know, the ice is melting, yes, but it's still an unforgiving environment, one that is very unpredictable. So if anything did go wrong up there, if there was an oil spill, it would be nearly impossible to clean up because it's just such a hard area to access. And the article that Mackenzie Funk wrote, you know, clearly outlines that and how there was a Coast Guard rescue team that had to be pulled in to save them. And, you know, the eight felonies that the company who was contracted out for the drilling that season that they were charged with.
And that's, you know, you start adding things up. The Russian government, their oil, I know that I read somewhere that they had a hard time selling it because the quality was so bad. Then Shell goes in and they run aground and they get evacuated by helicopter. And my question is, and if we have to go to break before you answer the full, you know, get to answer it fully, doesn't it really take time? Couldn't it be massive spill before it was even detected? That's what worries me. It's like really out in the middle of the Arctic. So spills could occur that would be so prolific and do so much damage, we might not even learn about them for quite some time. Is that true, or just would we know right
away? I think that's a good assumption, because certainly what we saw with the BP deepwater disaster in Louisiana is that they totally undersold how bad it was at first. And only after a month, and even after a month after that, did we actually find out how much oil was spilling and, you know, the extent of the damage.
And how people quickly forget, because they're still cleaning up there. There's still a ripple effect and a devastating impact and all kinds of habitat recreation. So could we just maybe not learn from the BP oil spill that this is not a good idea? We're going to have to take a break. I told you time would fly, Mary. It's going to. The name of our show today is Defending the Arctic. Joining us to talk about that is Mary Nicol. Mary is the National Activist Network Director at Greenpeace. And we will be right back. And Mary, when we come back, I'd like to talk about the very hot topic of what our current administration is doing and why it's important to leave everything right where it is. Everybody, stay here with us, please.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the Igloo radio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmer Glass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Can you predict the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And there's so much to think about today, and I hope everybody downloads this podcast to their gizmo and plays it and really decides at some point to get involved and be engaged and help us really save the Arctic. Shell Cares. I love that point, Mary, that you said, Shell Cares. Our guest today is Mary Nickel. She's the National Activist Network Director at Greenpeace. She project manages their office adaptation of Greenpeace Greenwire, a social network that allows Greenpeace supporters from across the globe to build strong relationships and run high impact campaigns together. Mary, thanks for joining us. I want to be on the scene with you someday. It's like what an exciting, you know, and something I read on your LinkedIn, which really touched me, is that you really specialize in engaging people to create change. And I think that's more needed now more than perhaps ever before in history.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's talk about the big question. What kind of report card does the current administration get in terms of protecting the Arctic? Are they fulfilling their responsibility to us?
Definitely not, unfortunately. You know, and it breaks my heart. I'm originally from Chicago, and I was there the night that in Grant Park when President Obama was elected and spoke, you know, very elegantly about how he was going to be the president to take a stand and be a climate leader. And we certainly haven't seen that from him in many issues, but particularly this one. So just a few weeks ago, giving Shell another green light, there's more permits that they need to be granted. But so far, it looks like the administration is giving Shell the go-ahead to go up and drill for oil in the Arctic.
You know, it kind of leaves me speechless, which is not a good place for a radio talk show host to be. We don't want to have a big, like, pregnant pause on the radio, but it's like getting kicked in the stomach to me. And I try to keep the show apolitical because, to me, the planet is not about politics. It's about preservation and people. So how could an administration, any administration, not be a champion for the planet? It makes me sick, especially, like you said, the history of what we're going to do and caving on that because of what, money, lobbyists, the almighty dollar, D, all of the mm-hmm. above?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you know, when you look at the political system and who has influence in politics in the United States, you know, it's not surprising that these sort of decisions get made because certainly the fossil fuel industry has done an amazing job influencing leaders like Obama. And so as heartbreaking as it is, you know, this problem really goes down to, you know, who is able to influence politics and at what level. But the, you know, the exciting thing that we've seen is that it isn't always about money. It's also about people. And so you saw a great, amazing resistance movement that's still alive and well around the Keystone XL pipeline. When that project was first introduced, it was said to be a done deal. And the same sort of movement right now is starting to brew around saving the Arctic, where people, you know, just this weekend, you know, an activist up in Bellingham decided to take direct action on one of the vessels up there. And so people are just starting to figure out what is their niche, what is their contribution that they can make to stopping this thing. And it's, you know, sometimes for someone it might be, you know, putting your body on the line, but for someone else it might be, you know, making a call to the port commission.
And I remember it's one of the, like, Kodak moments of my life when I was meeting with a climate group in Arizona, and one of the men, he was like in his mid-70s, he was going to protest for the Keystone Pipeline and, you know, against it. And I said, so what's your goal? And he said, to get arrested. He said, I care so much about it. And I'm like, you go, dude. You're 72 years old or 73, and you care that much to travel there and be a part of it. But I think that's the kind of things that you're seeing in your role, at least I hope so, in terms of people becoming more active and finding their voice.
That's right, yeah, and that's been, you know, I got involved into this work because an organizer took a chance on me and invited me to be involved in the campaign she was running now 12 years ago. And so that is part of the work, too, that we need to do is because, you know, we'll never match Shell's billions. There's no way. And they are going to fight tooth and nail as long as they can to keep their profit margins up. But what we can fight with is people and, you know, really connect with people around values and share stories and share how if we come together, you know, we can be that David that overpowers the Goliath.
And we just have to keep hope for that. And this is kind of a devil's advocate question, but I think I know the answer. It's either that or a rhetorical question. Has there ever in the history of oil drilling, as we know it, been an oil spill that an oil company has successfully cleaned up completely? I mean, it's like once it's out of the bottle, it's out. You can't shove it back in. Are there oil spills that have been cleaned up completely? How can that happen?
Not that I know of, and I think as the saying goes, oil and water don't mix. it's not a thing that you can clean up. You know, I don't have the exact figure in my head right now, but there's only a certain, if you're actually able to get to the oil, there's only a certain percentage that you're able to recover. And even in, you know, the warm waters of the Deepwater Horizon still, you know, nowhere near cleaned up. You can only imagine what it would be like when it's, you know, ice cold, frigid conditions with unexpected, you know, Arctic storms coming through.
Yeah,
what
we're
that
gonna
would
suck
be like to try and
up.
Clean up.
Yeah, it's not happening. Mm-hmm. It's just not happening. And mm-hmm. And it just goes, yeah. And the far-reaching implications for it going and going and going. Let me ask you this. How does something like, this is kind of a weird question, but how does the oil spill off the coast of Santa Barbara help or detract from the cause? Does it raise the consciousness? Does the administration pay more attention? Like, oh, wow, it's coming on American shores. We better pay attention. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, certainly here in Seattle, it's been at the tip of everyone's tongue. As far as, you know, this is an example of what we're fighting for. You know, I haven't necessarily seen any response from the administration, but you've got to think that this is, you know, right at this key juncture where they're, you know, just a few weeks ago, for the first time, Obama made a comment where he actually defended Shell. You know, and last year they weren't able to go up to the Arctic and drill for oil because the administration had, you know, told them, you failed so badly, you need to take a year to get your act together. And so, you know, President Obama came out defending the company, saying that, you know, they have gotten their act together. When actually you're seeing that, you know, one of their vessels was stopped in Hawaii and had an investigation, and a key part of their machinery was actually broken, the part that separates the oil from water. On their vessel. And so you're starting to see indicators that they don't have their act together. And you have to think that, you know, I would expect that the administration's PR people were pretty worked up when they found out that there's an oil spill that just happened in this pristine area when they're given the green light to go drill for oil in another pristine area.
It just makes me sick, but it's okay. Moving right along to what I think is a question I'd like to ask you, and I never put anybody in the spot, you might know it, but from my history of doing this as Mrs. Green for 9 years, isn't there a lot? It feels like it's a powder keg to me, because a lot of the equipment that's out there in the oceans and the rigs that are set up and the drilling that's going on, there's lots of old parts and potentials for breakdown. Is that something I just made up, or is that your assessment about really what else could happen?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that we've seen time and time again is that, in particularly the article I mentioned earlier, the Mackenzie Funk article in the New York Times Magazine, really outlines how these fossil fuel companies are cutting corners. You know, in the Deepwater disaster, the same thing happened because these companies were cutting corners. So, you know, I haven't toured the Polar Pioneer, so I can't tell you, and I would have no idea, like, is it in good shape or not? But time and time again, you know, we know that Shell is in this for the money. They're in this to keep their stock prices up and making a 10-year bet that this will pay off for them without having any proof. But, you know, it's fair to assume that, you know, they're, again, going to be cutting corners and, you know, not doing this in the safe way that they need to, as they showed us in 2012.
And, you know, I just encourage everybody, and I do this throughout the show, and I'm really excited about a website. Everybody should go to the greenpeace.org website, and from where I sit, you'll really want to stay there. Some of the people doing the writing for it are hysterical, because, I mean, it's like I'm laughing out loud even that it's really not happy stuff, but, you know, Kayaktivists, that's pretty clever. I just think when you do hashtag Kayaktivists, I like reading things like that. And the beautiful photography, I mean, it inspires you to want to click, click, clip, and help to, you know, fuel the wind behind this global movement. What about just the simple yes or no? Do you think when something like this happens in Santa Barbara, does it help maybe put the environmentalists and up on higher gear, or listening a little bit closer? Does that make sense? Like, or more carefully? I mean, that was ugly, and it was big, and it was awful, and it was really close. And it made me start thinking about oil spills, because I knew you were going to be on the show, and I was so excited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think... you know, as far as from like a organizing perspective, I've definitely met people who got engaged for the first time because of the BP oil spill and it happened in their backyard. So oftentimes it's the emotion of it, the fact that this happened in my backyard and my place where I go surfing and my, you know, place where I grew up learning how to fish with my dad, that often is the thing that brings people into action. And so, you know, I could probably bet a fair amount of money that in the next few years in my work, I'll likely meet some people who are activated because of the oil spill in Santa Barbara.
It's just, and I don't know, people were asking me about it, and I said, just wait, because once it comes knocking on our shores, people tend to think a little bit more globally instead of being so myopic about, oh, it's not happening here, so, you know, it's not my business, or mm-hmm. I don't care about it. It just brings it front and center. Can you talk a little bit about the overall campaign? This is a strategy for Greenpeace. Mm-hmm. This is one of your campaigns. Can you talk about a little bit, we'll go in depth a little more about, you know, why is, of all the issues, why is this one of your campaigns? It takes money and resources and team work. Why, what is the motivation between, you know, for picking Arctic drilling?
Sure. Yeah, so, you know, we're a nonprofit, so we have a limited amount of resources, so we need to be really thoughtful and strategic about where we spend our time and where we think we can make the biggest impact. So globally as an organization, one of the global campaigns is the Save the Arctic campaign for a variety of different reasons. One is because of the nature of who Greenpeace is, the fact that we have boats and we're able to, follow vessels across the middle of the ocean and those sorts of things. And we're particularly well-suited to add value to fighting to protect this area of the globe, as well as it has such big impacts for the climate and trying to make sure that we have a livable planet for all future generations. But like you said, there is a couple of different strategies that we're pursuing with the campaign. Like I said, we're up against, some of the most powerful governments in the world, some of the most powerful corporations in the world. Very much we are working to build a people's movement around this. Massive cultural change progressive change has always been led by people's movements, and so we're investing a lot of time and resources into that. We're also working to, directly influence the Obama administration's policy around this, because we know that they are, they're the folks that give the permits and, have a all or above energy policy right now. And so working to shift that and influence that and highlight the fact that, Shell is not a company that you want to be in bed with. They, time and again have shown that they are, cutting corners and aren't up for the tough task of what it takes to drill for oil up in this area of the globe. But as well as, at the end of the day, our big mega goal is to establish an Arctic sanctuary in the uninhabitable areas around the North Pole, where there would not be access to industrial fishing or mining or oil drilling. That area would be protected for all future generations, and then the peoples up there that subsist off the land would still have access to it, but we would make sure to protect it from those destructive practices.
And then what I wonder about is, what about two questions come to mind. One is, what are the people in the Arctic, the governments, the intergovernmental organizations, the citizens, where are they standing on this? Are they getting activated? Do they have a, what if Shell keeps it up and there is a big oil spill? What are they going to do? Where are they in the leadership of this Arctic preserve, which sounds like just the best thing that can happen for every citizen on the planet? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, the tough thing about international politics, as it
is that they're
goes,
international politics. Yeah,
there you go. And in particular, around climate change, the past decade, we've seen a bunch of great agreements happen that are non-binding, and so that is the sort of thing that you can't actually shift society if you have these non-binding climate agreements. But in particular, with the Arctic, there is something called the Arctic Council. Which is the intergovernmental forum of the countries that border the Arctic. So, it's Canada, U.S., Greenland, some of the Nordic countries, Russia. They all have representatives to the Arctic Council. And so they, meet every so often and, are the kind of informal governing body of that area. And we've definitely been putting a lot of pressure on them to start to, previously the management has been a lot of based on, resource extraction and whatnot. And so we're starting to, the conversation with them around, protecting this area and making sure that this area, is around for a lot longer than all of us are.
And I'm just curious, when they have those meetings, are they open to the public? Does Greenpeace have a place at the table, or are they allowed to at least come in and observe what's being discussed?
Yeah, so I'm not exactly sure about the very particular details of it, because I've never been up there myself. But we've definitely, there was one recently up in Canada where we had sent a Greenpeace delegation to. And there were opportunities, similar to the climate negotiations that happen once a year. There's some bits that are, public and some bits that are behind closed doors. And there's opportunities for NGOs like Greenpeace to engage and have a say in what's happening.
And some voice, at least waking people up. That's a really good one. So everybody, we're coming up on the next break. Time is flying when you're learning such important information. Please stay with us. The name of our show today is Defending the Arctic. And joining us to talk about that is Mary Nickel. We'll be right back. Please stay here with us. There's more good stuff. Mary, when we come back, what I'd really like to talk about, and I keep going away from it, is how do you actually mount the campaigns? I mean, you have a really big position, and some of like the actual, what do you do to mount a campaign? And if we have time, there are really good reasons why Arctic drilling is a really bad idea. It's on your website, and I'd like to talk about that a little bit more when we come back. Everybody, stay here with us. Oil drilling, it impacts us all.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With 5 ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And for this show, we're asking you to think about drilling for oil in the Arctic. Shell is ready to go. Our show has been exciting for me, informative, and our guest is Mary Nickel. Mary is the National Activist Network Director at Greenpeace. She project manages their office's adaptation of Greenpeace Greenwire, a social network that allows Greenpeace supporters from across the globe to build strong relationships and run high-impact campaigns together. And Mary, I just have to say, so many successful campaigns. So we just have to hope for this one because it's a big one. Shell is a giant. You're absolutely and positively right. So can you just give us a little bit about, I mean, there really is a master plan that people can find on your website that started, I think, in 2013. Like, let's get going. Arctic drilling is a no-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So, Greenpeace has been working on this campaign globally for the past several years. One of the things about that's really shifted in the past few months since January, really, since the Port of Seattle announced that they were bringing Shell's drilling fleet to town, is that this issue just became much more understandable for folks, I think, because, you think about the Arctic, I don't know what comes up for you, but maybe, you think about the North Pole, Santa Claus, whatnot. It's this area of the globe that's so far away from where many people live that it's hard for folks to wrap their minds around and hard to connect with. But what happened, the campaign really started to take off and explode when people saw what these drilling rigs look like and what, you stand up next to it and it's 7 stories tall and it looks like something from Star Wars. Ugh. And so it really gives you a sense of
the dark
side.
Definitely,
yeah.
The dark side.
What, I can't believe they're going to take this thing and go up there and try and drill for oil that we, don't need anyways, and that we can't burn if we're going to have a habitable climate. Because of, it just takes a spark for these sorts of things to take off. And so really here in the United States, in the same way that you started to see around the Keystone XL movement, is people are really starting to understand what's at stake. They're starting to understand how they can stand in solidarity with people in Alaska, indigenous people who've been working on this issue for so long, and support them in their efforts to save their backyards. And folks are really starting to see this as an inspiring moment where if people across the climate movement and people who don't identify as activists are able to come together and stand hand in hand, that we may be able to stop this thing.
So because of your background in local organizing, in facilitation and training, and engaging people to create change, when you talk about those moments of people saying, aha, how do you get them engaged? Like, what are the ways that you use personally to kind of maximize that interest and get that emotional hook set? What's the magic that Mary works?
Well, you know, I don't know if I've exactly figured it all out, but, you know, part of it is, you know, just connecting with people on their values, what they care about, but as well as just, you know, telling a really compelling story and demystifying what it means to be active and be engaged. You know, I think here in Seattle in particular, there's such an amazing history of activism. And then as well as the community here has done an amazing job fighting coal exports and oil trains, all these destructive industries that, you know, have to kind of come through the Pacific Northwest in order to be shipped off to other countries. Someone described the Pacific Northwest to me when I first got here as the cork in the bottle. If we can stop them here, you know, we can stop a lot of these big industrial practices. And so there are these amazing networks that already exist here of people, you know, who are able to activate their friends and family during these big moments. And this is the sort of thing that it started to snowball, so to speak. And people are really coming out of the woodwork and understand because of the, you know, because of the images that people have come together to produce and because of the fact that this started in a closed door, you know, kind of corrupt political process where the port was negotiating behind closed doors before becoming public and letting, you know, Seattleites know that they signed this deal with Shell Oil. There was a lot of material to work with here.
Right. You had a very verdant pasture, so to speak. And, you know, to answer what you said, I think most people, when you think of the Arctic, you know, the first thing I think of is how cold it is and freezing and unrelenting and if you have to go and do anything up there. But I also think of polar bears and its connection to our magnificent ocean. So I think for most people, even if you live in the desert, the ocean is a very emotional issue if you can make people connect the dots that what's happening up there will impact what happens on the beaches all over the world. It's not just going to stay contained to what Shell has in mind for their, you know, their Arctic plans. So that's my rant on that. And is there, I don't know if you know this, but is there dissent within the Obama administration? Because it seems to me that the Department of the Interior would have this as a major concern and a major hotspot to care about. Do you have any intel on that? I mean, it's fine if you don't, but I would think that there are people within the administration that are saying, are you kidding me right now? We have to do something.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about that. You know, there's definitely a reason why I could never, you know, work for government. I'm not willing to compromise on these issues. But that's what, you know, the Obama administration has done, is that they've decided to compromise on the climate, and there's one thing I know about science is you can't get away with that. So, you know, this is a moment where they have the opportunity to do the right thing and to actually be the climate leader that, you know, President Obama has said that he wanted to be at the beginning of his term.
Oh, and just, yeah, it's like we all should press pause a minute, take a deep breath and think about what we're going to do. So when you're launching a campaign, talk about some of the key ingredients. Is it social media? Is it people that are already supporters of Greenpeace? What do you, Mary, do to start really activating your network, especially based on what happened in Seattle and Santa Barbara. You've gotten some good fuel for the fire, so to speak. I cannot believe I use that term, but it's that's not a good choice, but some information to work with.
Sure. Yeah. So I think, you know, anytime starting a grassroots organizing campaign, the first step is just to talk to your friends and neighbors and other organizations out there that are already doing great social change work. And see, you know, if they have anything planned and see, you know, what they're up to. So that's the thing that in January, when the decision became public that the Port of Seattle had signed this lease with Shell, that's the first thing that we started to do is, you know, talk around to the other groups and people that had great networks here to see what their interest was and how they wanted to collaborate. And then from there, you know, it's coming up with some agreed upon goals. Here are the things that we want to that we want to accomplish together, either on our own, if you're going at it alone, or as a group. And then figuring out from there, okay, what are the tactics and the various things that we can use to tell, to engage people and tell the story. So one of the things here in Seattle that we did is, you know, started to engage people around these court commission hearings where people could go, you know, speak truth to power and share personal testimony around why they care about protecting the Arctic and why they're so upset at their port commissioners for allowing this to happen. To doing things like even before May 16th, we held a public rally on April 26th where 1,000 people came together to hear from amazing speakers, to connect and collaborate, and then another opportunity to speak truth to power where we were able to deliver 8,000 petition signatures in a kayak to the port commissioner's office to let them know that we're going to still continue to ask them to rescind the lease and that we won't be backing down. So it's been a combination of, you know, starting talking with, you know, everyone who you can think of to talk to, then bringing those group of people to come up with some goals, and then just unleashing from there and letting people do what they do best.
And I have said this on the show so many times, we've got the power. People really do have the power in almost every situation, and it's activating that and feeling like you can be a part of making a difference. And I say to people when I do public speaking, sign a petition, write your congressman, whatever it looks like for you, join in a protest, become a member of an organization, because we really do have people power if we collaborate and, you know, get a common vision for what we want for this planet. It's never been more important than now, if you ask me. It's getting more and more dire each day unless we roar loudly.
That's right.
What about the possibility of, you said earlier in the show that Shell pays attention, something like this. Don't quote me because I was listening, but I don't remember exactly what you said. But Shell cares when protests like this start popping up. Do they care because their investors get nervous, because their shareholders get nervous? Why does Shell give a rat's darn? How's that? I didn't curse on the air. a rat's darn. Hashtag that one. But I don't really want to use profanity on the show. But why would Shell care at all about what the people think?
Yeah. That's a great question. And, you know, if you start to pay attention, start to look for their logos in different events that you're attending, whether it's a golf match or they sponsor Jazz Fest down in New Orleans. And so part of their strategy, similar to what the tobacco companies did for many, many years, is to, you know, build themselves as a good, you know, company that is green and has these safe practices. They want to build up their social license so that when people see their logo, they think, oh, yeah, Shell, you know, that's my gas company or that's my gas station. They don't see the things like what, you know, Shell has caused in Nigeria and has destroyed, you know, and caused a lot of trauma for the Ogoni people down there. And so it's part of their corporate strategy to build up their image. And so when people are able to point a finger at them and point out their bad act, when they've acted poorly, you know, in 2012, when they, you know, the company they hired was convicted of 8 felonies for how they handled themselves in trying to drill for oil, you know, that's all stuff that impacts them. And so, you know, from between the 16th and then some more activities that happened on May 18th in, here in town, it was right before Shell's annual shareholder, annual general meeting that happened.
Perfect.
And we saw their stock prices. Yeah, their stock price fell $3.
Oh, that'll get their attention.
And
oh, my gosh. That's a
significant drop. Attention.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then as well as during the shareholder meeting, you know, climate and talking about the Arctic drilling project is definitely something that the investors care about, and that's something that gets their attention too. And so we know that they're really afraid of ordinary people coming together and taking action, because history has shown that, you know, we can come together and stop these massive projects.
And it's just so important and inspirational to me. Every time I hear about campaigns like this, and I don't think you can even spread yourself too thin. You can like a post on Facebook. It's that simple. Follow Greenpeace on Facebook and decide. And the Shell commercials on TV are like disgusting. You'll see this maniac mm-hmm. yelling at the TV, no matter who's over, "You are such liars. Why are you trying to brainwash us into thinking you care? You care about earnings per share and profits, and that's it." And you know, the thing that I just have to reflect on is that from everything you've said, it doesn't even make sense for them to go there. It's expensive. It's treacherous conditions. And the oil that they get is poor quality. So I'm not quite sure what the big payback is for them on doing this. They're causing a lot of commotion. So that's a big mystery to me. Why are they going ahead with it when it's just going to make people, you know, roar more loudly?
Yeah, and what it gets down to, you know, Naomi Klein is another author to check out.
And
she wrote this book recently called Have you read it?
Oh, this changes everything. And I want to write to her and say, Naomi, thank you so much because you really changed everything for me. Mm-hmm. I just gave the book away to my best friend and I said, you have to read this because I can't talk to anybody about it unless they've read the book. Powerful book.
Powerful stuff, and I think one of the thesis statements that she talks about is, you know, the fossil fuel industry, they've gotten the easy stuff to get to. And so now they have to go to the extreme ends of the globe. And what it's about is about keeping their stock prices up. Because if they can say they have X billions of barrels in their reserve, even if they don't have, you know, it officially on a barge headed somewhere, that keeps their stock prices up. So that's what they're fighting for right now. They're fighting for profit.
And if it's not about the money, it's about the money. And we're not going to talk about Monsanto because their commercials are right up there too. At Monsanto, we care about our planet and the people on it. And I'm like, no, really, you don't. And you just have a lot of money to have highly produced, very professionally done commercials that make us think you're good and kind. So I think I've done a lot of ranting on this show, Mary. I hope it's okay. It's a hot spot for me.
It's your show.
To me, it's one of the pristine areas left on the planet. And I'm so excited that Greenpeace cares enough to have it be one of their major campaigns. I think the whole world should be aware of it and thank them. And we have about a minute and a half or maybe 2 minutes left. What would you love in your dream world for people that are listening to it? And we really have a big reach now because we have so many networks that are carrying the shows. What would you say, as soon as you stop listening to this show, do this? What would be like the first three things you'd like to ask people to do, the call to action?
Yeah. Wow. What a great opportunity. I think I would take a moment and just think for yourself what sort of future that you see and what sort of future that you want to be a part of.
I love that.
I
do. I'm serious.
Good. Yeah, because that's what it's about. You know, it's not about these short-term things. It's about future generations and what sort of planet and what sort of environment that we're leaving for our children. And so I think once you're connected to that and once you have a reason that really moves you and lights a fire in your belly, it's then asking yourself, okay, what sort of power and access do I have? You know, maybe it's you're active on Twitter and you have a bunch of followers and you can start, you know, being someone who's tweeting constantly about the campaign. or maybe, you know, you're someone who has a little extra money and you can, you know, help fund some of the groups that are involved in this fight. Or maybe you're someone who is willing to come out, you know, fly out to Seattle and join us in the trenches here as we continue to build the movement out here. I think you've mentioned it a lot of different ways during the show. There's so many different ways for people to contribute.
It is just getting engaged. Yes.
Just get engaged, and everything that people do matters.
Okay, I've got to wrap it up. Mary Nickel, I'll be following you. June 6th, Coach Mark Smallwood, Executive Director of Rodale Institute, about organic farming. Make it a great green week. Thanks for being a part of my world.